Happy Monday, everybody. This is John Hansen in for John Williams. I take you till 2. For the next hour, we do the Wintrust Business Lunch. We got a lot to get to today, and the market's seemingly a little bit in the green here, which is always good news. They've been on a little bit of a roller coaster. I guess that's what stock markets do, Elise Glink. You know Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media, Best Money Moves, and the host of This Week in Wealth with Tom Fortino on Sundays here on WGN at 6:30 a.m. Let's first talk about, you got a free new weekly newsletter, right?
I do. You can get it at thinklink.com. Just go there and sign right up.
It's love, money, and real estate. Ooh,
right.
That's fun.
What could be more important, John?
Yeah, the three things in life that matter most.
That's right.
All
that's
in
right.
One place. Okay, so I know a lot of people are wondering, you know, after the Fed chairman spoke now 2 weeks ago or so, that sent markets losing a lot of what we had gotten in the summer. And then in the last week or so, we've started to get them back again. What's going on with the markets?
Yeah, I have no idea. It's almost as if there are two markets going on and
yes.
There's a lot of competition, because we are seeing some real negative news and some pushing down, and then all of a sudden the markets have popped back up. It almost seems as though they don't mind the fact that the Federal Reserve Bank chairman, Jerome Powell, has indicated he's probably going to do another huge raise this week. I think it's this week.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at almost 0.75 point, I think, is where everybody's kind of landed in the bond market. Another 0.75 point rise. And for what, you know, consumers, that means higher interest rates, higher costs for mortgages, especially if you have adjustable rate mortgages. And also it means if you've got credit card debt, you're going to be paying more as well.
I just, you know, ever since I started doing Your Money Matters, maybe it's just because I'm paying attention more, but you're right about this two different market thing. And it's, you know, maybe they already had, you know, that big drop off we saw over the last 2 weeks before last Wednesday was the drop from the 0.75 point thing. And people are just, you become accustomed to it. And now the market's already looking well past this announcement.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, if you look at the Dow, the year to date change is, it's still down about 11%. And the 1 year, year over year change, the Dow is still down 6%. So we're a lot better than where we were. But I wouldn't exactly say that, you know, we're completely back to where we ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at NASDAQ, year to date change still down 21%, 21.8%. And the 1 year change year over year is still 19%. So we're still technically in a bear market for NASDAQ, which basically is made up of a lot of tech stocks, the big heavy tech stocks.
I imagine there's a lot of hope, just based on gas prices alone, that the new CPI data will continue to show maybe not a decline, but a decline in the year over year inflation numbers. Is that driving a little hope for today?
I think it is. And I think if you look at the price of oil and the price of gas, you know, oil is $87 a barrel, $87.75. That is so much lower. It's like $50 less than where it was in the height of things. And so if you're seeing less pain at the gas pump, like I went and filled up the tank over at Costco over the weekend, and I think we paid, like at Costco, maybe 4.25,
mm-hmm.
Somewhere around there. So much better than nearly $6 a gallon.
Yeah, yes.
It was just like, wow, that's amazing. So I think that people are starting to see that there's less pain at the pump. And, you know, in some travels that we've done, it was even less expensive. We were out in Utah last week for doing a little hiking, and gas prices were less there.
And people feeling good actually does make a difference in the markets.
It does. It's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy,
right?
If you think about it, it's like, well, if you're worried that inflation's going to be a problem and you see prices going up, and it almost as if it's foretelling that prices are going to go up. I don't know why the psychology of it is that we imagine the worst and then the worst happens. It doesn't always work out like that. But when
yes.
you look at consumer confidence surveys, oftentimes they are predictors of what will happen.
I know a lot of people are going down to the basement. Things are a little sloshy this morning, Elise Glink. That's never fun. I'm in the process of buying a home, and boy, don't I wish I knew every detail about whether it has flooded ever or not. We don't always have access to that data, but it does make a difference in what we're willing to do to buy it, doesn't it?
It does. It's interesting. Redfin, which is a big real estate brokerage company, national in scope, or just about national, I should say, they do a lot of different kinds of surveys. And they released a survey this morning that homebuyers who have access to flood risk data tend to bid on lower risk homes. And I thought that was so interesting because when you look at what goes on with flooding, and I was hearing from different people who work for Best Money Moves today, and they're like, you wouldn't believe what was going on in Ravenswood last night, for example, or out in the western suburbs. Nobody wants to deal with a flooded basement. And yet with increased climate change and these kinds of crazy rains we're seeing and other kinds of climate disasters, it's something you really have to consider.
No, for sure. I mean, it matters so much to the value of your home, the headache you're going to have to deal with, future costs that you may have to do. And my palms are getting sweaty as I'm talking about this right now because I didn't see what happened in the basement yesterday. Sorry, Elise. We talked about this earlier, and I know the listener who heard already is like, move on already. But I mean, it really does make a difference. Do they have any advice or what people should do to figure and to adjust accordingly?
Well, it's interesting. I think what most people don't realize is that FEMA, which governs flood insurance, the National Flood Insurance Policy, and you can find out more of this at FEMA.gov, F-E-M-A.gov. You know, FEMA deals with not just flooding and flood insurance and all that, but, you know, obviously with major catastrophes, physical catastrophes around the country. But what I think people don't realize is that over the last, let's say, dozen years or so, FEMA has redrawn flood maps across the country. And what they've seen in these flood maps is that homes that were previously not in a flood area or a flood zone or might have been in a 1,000-year flood zone, maybe that's been upgraded to a 100-year flood zone. Now, that's still sounds like it's not that much, right? And your average risk score, there's a flood risk score on sort of where you are and how likely it is, people who have severe and extreme risks about flood insurance, you know, flood zones are now buying less expensive homes, ostensibly because they realize they're going to have problems. And so they might as well, you know, downsize the amount that they spend
right,
to be able to save more for when these disasters happen.
And maybe change their behavior once they're in the house. Don't finish that basement, you know? Right? There's other things you can do to try and minimize the damage when it comes.
Yeah, there are. It's really interesting when you look out, and one of the things that we've tracked over the last, you know, couple of decades is the amount of money that's being spent to clean up climate catastrophes. And I'm going to say that when you've got, we had this about 3 weeks ago, we had three 1,000-year events within the span of about a week and a half in this country. They weren't here in Chicago, although a 5-inch rainstorm is certainly
right,
something to, I don't know when the last time we had one of those, but it certainly wasn't 500 years ago or even 100 years ago. I'm remembering, you know, we've had Septembers where we've had very, very significant rainfall all within a 3-week period. But when you look back over the number of climate catastrophes that we have in this country just involving water, just this summer, you realize that if you're not paying attention to flood insurance and the need for flood insurance, you should be. And that's really where the National Flood Insurance Program steps in. It has to be reauthorized every year by Congress. But what it does is it allows a network of private insurance companies to have the insurance back-ended by the government. So if you have flood insurance, you get protected up to, I think it's $250,000.
Is it because it's such a risky thing for insurance companies, they don't even want to offer it, but at least if it's backed up by the federal government, they'll take on that risk to insure the customers?
That's basically what's going on here. Now, it also helps to standardize the cost of flood insurance, and that's a problem for a lot of people and the reason that Congress has to keep reauthorizing this. If you think about it, you know, we're here in Chicago. It's not like Lake Michigan, which we have seen rise up. It's down a little bit now. Mm-hmm. But if you're living on the coast of Florida, for example, or anywhere around the Gulf Coast or in the, you know, on the West Coast, you know, we talk a lot about how seas are rising. And one of the things that flood insurance protects you against is a rising tide of water, whether that's caused by a rainstorm or it's caused by, you know, the oceans coming up. And so for people who live on the coast of Florida, for example, the predictions about how high the oceans are going to get and how that's going to swamp a lot of Florida has means that those people, if you do this by risk-based adjusted pricing, they should be paying more. But they don't because of what goes on with trying to sort of normalize pricing for flood insurance all over the country. And so, you know, here in Chicago, flood insurance is fairly affordable if you are affected by what happened over the last day and a half. Mm-hmm. And I'm so sorry if that's you and you're carting out wet, dirty, you know, flooded carpet. I'm so sorry. Consider getting flood insurance.
Okay. And Lou Manfredini, by the way, is going to stop by in the 1 o'clock hour to help those people out a little bit. This answer deserves more than a minute, but it's all we have time for, Elise. Speaking of real estate, I think people are torn between this is a correction we're seeing. We're starting to see value of homes go down after being really inflated for a little bit, or prices go down, I should say. And some people saying this is 2008 all over again. Is the truth probably somewhere in the middle, or where do you fall on that?
We're nowhere close to 2008.
Okay.
2008 was about 10 million homeowners who had bought homes that they really couldn't afford, except if everything went perfectly in their lives. And when massive amounts of people lost their jobs, they couldn't afford it. Today, we have 11.2 or something like that million job openings and only half as many people looking for jobs. There's plenty of work out there. The work is paying more. People are getting better paid. And so they can't afford their mortgages. So this is just a little bit of a correction. Don't worry, we're not at 2008.
Yeah, and that puts me at ease a little bit. And a lot of people who bought inflated houses, a lot of them were buying in cash too, meaning they're already done.
Yeah, there's a lot of positive equity now, meaning that people have paid down those mortgages, or a lot of people are holding mortgages at 2, 2.5, 3%, well below where interest rates are today. They are in great shape. There's huge amounts of equity out there in the marketplace. If you're, you know, not selling, you don't have to worry about where prices are going. So please take a breath. We're not at 2008.
That's just one part of the new free weekly newsletter. That's the real estate part. There's love and money, too. Go to thinklink.com with the newsletter button. Elise, always good to talk with you.
You too. Take care, John.
And obviously, This Week in Wealth, Sundays at 6:30 a.m. with Tom Fortino here on WGN Radio. And a regular guest here is Jim Dahlke, senior editor of Chicago Inno, chicagoinno.com. And Jim, as always, great to have you on.
Hey, John, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. I love the idea of Roomy, a Chicago startup, making it easier for us to move and a whole bunch of other things dealing with furniture. And it's only here in Chicago, right?
That's right. Yes, this new Chicago startup called Roomy, that's R-O-O-M-I-I, they call themselves the Airbnb of furniture, which is a concept I just totally love. So essentially, it's a platform that lets you rent or buy furniture online. So really, this is a platform for those of us who are a bit more transient, and certainly a startup that can come in handy in this remote work environment where people can kind of live and work anywhere, and you don't necessarily need to be tied down to one place, and paying a few bucks a month versus thousands to rent to buy a couch is certainly an attractive option for some people. So this is a Chicago startup just getting started here in the city. They're going to start in Chicago first and kind of slowly expand from there. But really interesting new startup here in Chicago.
Do they deliver it to your house and take it away when you're done?
That's right. So, this is really a big selling point here. If you get a new job and are ready to move, no longer do you need to head to Facebook Marketplace to kind of unload some furniture if you aren't ready to kind of bring everything with you. So it really allows that kind of living flexibility that I think so many sort of Gen Zers and young folks are certainly interested in.
I don't know. Why wasn't this here 10 years ago? That's all I just got to say, because the number of times I bought and sold different things just because I didn't want to move everything, and then you realize you need something and you just pay per month. Obviously, if you keep it for the length of it, you'll probably pay more than it was worth when you bought it, but it's the ease that you have with it. And it's fun. I imagine that they have a great little app that you probably click on little things and you look at what you want and you order it and you tell them what day you move in, they get there. That seems genius.
Yeah, so a few examples. Right now you can do a leather armed arm sofa for about $77 a month. They have a standing desk that you can rent for about $46 a month. Leather chair for about $40 per month. And you know, I think what's interesting here is too is there's also a B2B element here. So they have an element where they can rent furniture to businesses as well. So same kind of deal, right? A business that's got many employees working remotely, but maybe you're doing a bit back to the office test period for a few months. You need some standing desks, some more chairs. Sofa here and there, and there's definitely a B2B opportunity for Roomie here as well.
Roomie, R-O-O-M-I-I. What is it with startups and weird vowel locations and usage? I don't know. They love doing that, but that's what it is. Okay, let's talk about FranShares, alternative investments in a down economy. I know a lot of people looking for ways to make money even when the markets are down.
Yeah, so this is a Chicago startup, FranShares. They want to give anybody the chance to invest in franchises. So think restaurant chains, barbershops, and they really believe they're opening up an entire new asset class for retail investors. So this is a business founded in 2020, and their investment platform brings fractional franchise ownership to any investor. So not just accredited investors, their sort of whole deal is that for as little as $500, you can start investing in fractional ownership of these franchises. Officially got the launch just a couple months ago, but got some funding in the bank already, raised about $1.5 million in a round led by Chicago Ventures just last year. So this is, you know, it's certainly interesting, right? Especially in a squirrely stock market and, you know, the traditional investing avenues maybe aren't providing the return that they have been over the last few years. FranShares believes that, hey, we can open up, you know, a brand new asset class for investors and allow you to put some money into franchises. So they work with a handful of different types of franchises where you can invest. And really, like I said, for as little as 500 bucks, you can start to own pieces of these franchises.
That's really cool stuff. It's interesting. I'm just going to read the lead to this article because it was written so well. Kaur Pharmaceuticals secured $30 million in financing this week to reprogram the way your immune system works. Ooh, that hooked me in. Explain it a little bit.
Yeah, so this is a pharma startup here in Chicago. And really kind of what they've do, they've created a nanoparticle platform that uses the immune system's learning power to induce tolerance to specific antigens.
So I didn't understand a word of what that meant. I'm sorry. Can you explain it to me like I'm five?
Yeah, so basically they've created a lead product for celiac disease. It's really one of the most promising so far. And they stopped short of saying it's actually going to cure the disease, but they've created some therapies that can really help you deal with it in a way that's sort of really novel. And, you know, not only that, they also are working with allergens. So you can think peanut allergies, for example. You know, current therapies can protect folks against one peanut, but they believe that their product here can really kind of completely keep people from, you know, having these adverse reactions to peanuts. And so, you know, they are very early in on this, but hey, $30 million in the bank is certainly a big step forward to getting this to market and to making some real significant advancements in how people deal with different diseases and different allergies.
Yeah, that's cool and well explained there. Really quickly here, VC funding is falling, but small startup cities are booming. And you're really talking about really smaller locations that seem to have these little booms, including Kirkland, Washington, Madison, Wisconsin nearby, Ann Arbor, Michigan, a lot of college towns here.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, 2021 was really a historic year for venture capital funding, just is through the roof in terms of the amount of money that was invested in startups. Things have certainly hit the brakes here in 2022. We've seen startups lay off thousands of workers across the country. And, you know, many investors have kind of hit the pause button, right, on sort of deploying capital into startups, at least compared to what happened in the last year. However, that's not exactly the case in some of these smaller, lesser-known startup cities. Kirkland, Washington, like you mentioned, saw startups raise about $300 million last quarter. That was about a 1,700% increase compared to its average quarterly funding amount. While Madison, like you also mentioned, also raised about $300 million, which was up nearly 800%. So I think what this shows is that even though VC funding nationally is down, there are still companies across the country and certainly non-traditional tech hubs that can certainly raise major capital and grow their businesses. Other startup cities on this list include Birmingham, Alabama, which came in at number 4th, Wilmington, Delaware, which came in at 5th, Ann Arbor, just behind them at number 6. So really interesting that, hey, you know, we're seeing a bit of a downturn in venture capital to startups, but, you know, really good businesses built on good fundamentals based in some non-traditional tech hubs can still raise capital.
Yeah. And who knows, that could be more of the way of the future. Instead of just one or two or three big tech hubs in the country, you could find very successful smaller municipalities that create good businesses. All right. We appreciate it, Jim Dahlke. ChicagoInno.com is where people can go. We'll talk soon. Okay.
Thanks, John.
All right, let's get the Wintrust Business Minute with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Land's End is getting a new CEO. The Dodgeville, Wisconsin-based company has hired American Eagle Outfitters president Andrew McLean. He'll replace the retiring Jerome Griffith next January. Land's End says McLean is an accomplished retail executive with a strong track record of driving significant growth, who will be the right person to lead the company in its next chapter. A popular southern restaurant has plans to open its first Chicago location. Crane says Yardbird of Miami Beach will open in River North this fall. The eatery has been eyeing Chicago for a while, but the pandemic slowed expansion plans. Yardbird will move into the space previously occupied by P.F. Chang's at 530 North Wabash. Its menu features items like chicken and waffles, skillet cornbread, and fried green tomato BLTs. Yardbird has locations in Miami, Los Angeles, Dallas, Washington, D.C., Las Vegas, and Singapore. It also has plans to open soon in Denver. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
All right, business of food, Steve Alexander.
Yes, and we are sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. We are 1-0. Let's go.
Oh, it's so exciting. I am a true Bears fan.
That's Raquel Fields, owner of 14 Parish Restaurant and Rum Bar in Hyde Park, and she has reason to be an even bigger Bears fan after her restaurant was chosen by the Bears as a small business all-pro. Which means what?
It means that we get to partner with the Bears to get some really, really great exposure for our restaurant. They're going to be doing tons of advertising on our behalf. We'll have the opportunity to get some presence inside of the stadium during home games.
Wow. Well, you know, we have the equivalent of several football stadiums full of people listening right now, Raquel. So go ahead and brag about your restaurant.
Oh, wow. So 14 Parish is a really awesome space. Since the pandemic, we're actually the only exclusively rum bar in Chicago. So we have over 125 different rum labels on our bar. Our motto at 14 Parish is we bring paradise to everyday life. We have a fusion of Caribbean cuisine. So we kind of take Caribbean classics and re-envision them, or we'll take my background, which is African-American soul food, and we'll give it a Caribbean spin on it.
Of course, rum is an agricultural product. It's made mostly from sugarcane, and the taste of it can vary based on the soil in which it's grown.
For example, we have a wonderful rum called Puerto Angel, which is grown, the sugarcane is grown near agave plants. So it tastes a lot like tequila because it takes on the same flavor profile that you would find in an agave heart.
And while a lot of us got our start with rum and coke or the umbrella drinks, she says there are a lot of folks very serious about their rum.
We probably have some $500 bottles of rum, but we have something that's friendly for everyone. So if you're a true rum connoisseur, you're going to notice we have an entire shelf dedicated to those who are really interested, and they really spend a lot of time learning about rum.
14 Parish in Hyde Park, the Chicago Bears Small Business All-Star, from now till October 3rd. From the farm to your belly, today's National Chocolate Milkshake Day. That's the business of food and rum.
We like to say rum is a sip of paradise.
On 720 WGN.
And when you think about the hardships of the pandemic on the American workers and back to school season, a lot of it, even though things are changing slowly, falls to the women of this country who are incredibly burned out, as it turns out. Kimber Matarazzo is from C200. And Kimber, women really are bearing the brunt of a lot of the stress these days. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Yes, the women are bearing the brunt of it.
And how much? I mean, what are the numbers here in terms of women feeling burned out?
Well, we're finding that 53% of the women have higher stress levels than they have in the years before, even pre-pandemic levels. And they're even burnt out. About 46% of them are saying, you know, I'm completely burnt out. I don't even know if I should stay in the workforce anymore or find a new job. So they're really struggling.
And that's bearing out in the numbers, too. We're seeing in employment is that one of the groups that we really want back in the workforce from pre-pandemic age, of course, are women. And that's been a little bit of a sticking point for people, and they're participating in the Great Resignation. And obviously, that's everyone's individual choice. But Kimber, I imagine what you guys do at C200 is try and create a better opportunity or better ways to deal with this sort of stress.
Exactly. There are a couple things that we do at C200. One is, you know, really looking to help advance women in leadership. And really, you know, women need women. It's a strong peer community. So when we look at peer communities, women need to lean more on their communities to help them. So especially when they're stressed and have mental stress, they need those other women they can reach out to. They also need resources. You know, one of the things women tend to do is take it all on themselves. And they should really kind of outsource some of the things, even outsourcing it to friends, to paid resources, just making their lives a little more comfortable and easier to be able to balance that work and life balance together.
Is it just gathering and networking, or are there professionals brought in that are experts in this stuff?
Well, there's both. I mean, there's professionals, people who really do it really, really well and teach you to do it. But most women don't have access to those types of professionals. So we encourage women to be able to reach out to their other women to help them, their friends, their neighbors, and, you know, make it easier. You know, if you have kids that need to go to a carpool, you don't have to be the one that takes your child every day in the carpool. You know, find ways to lean on other mothers in the community.
How does it work? Is it do people sign up to join this? Is this they've got to be recommended? I mean, how do people get a part of C200?
Oh, for C200, C200 is a woman. It's a global organization which is about advancing women, and its CEOs is global CEOs. So it's a little different. But what we do is we use that global CEO, women who have been in these positions for so many years and have reached this high level, to really look back at women who need their help and mentor them and guide them, really sponsor them and help them understand these types of issues, that they don't have to take it all on their own, that they can actually, you know, lean to other women who have been there and done that, that have experience with it, and help guide them.
So is it women a matter of saying, hey, I need some help, and then reaching out to you guys to see what the resources are? What's the best way to do that?
That would be the best way. We have a program called Women Helping Women. So they reach out and say, hey, I need help. I'm struggling in these areas. We work with women in colleges who are starting new businesses, entrepreneurs who are just entering the corporate workforce. Even women who are, you know, in the C-suite or want to get in the C-suite, but who are in the C-suite already, who want to move into CEO roles, but really don't know how to do it. You know, they've been there for a while and they're struggling and they, you know, want to switch jobs or switch careers. It's how can we help guide them and use our women and our network and our peer community at C200 to really help them with women who understand what they're working on. Obviously. And how they can help progress them.
Right. And obviously this helps women out. But I imagine that the mission is obviously, and part of it is that this helps out the entire American worker. Men, women, it doesn't matter. That we want women who are able to balance that home life, work ethic, and work life to benefit all of us.
Exactly. We also need employers to help, right? We need employers who will help with flexible work schedules. So when the women are, you know, going to work and spending their day at work, that they're able to leave work and leave the work at work and not have to take it home. You know, with the days of technology, we're really on 24/7. And as long as we're completing our tasks during the time of work hours, or specifically not even within those work hours, if we complete the tasks, we should be able to handle some other things that we need to do personally.
Amen to that. C200.org is where people can get more information. Kimber, thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you.